So the question is, can employers utilize all the resources that are out there? Because some of them may not know about these approaches, because most people look at medicine as traditional approach. You have an illness, you go to the doctor, you get a prescription, you go home, and hopefully you get better. And if it does get better, you may need hospitalization or surgery. So I think more and more young people especially would like to take care of their own healthcare needs.
Constraints drive innovation. Hey everyone, it's Matt here for another episode of Thinking Inside the Box, a show where we discuss complex issues related to work and culture. If you're interested in checking out our other content, you can find us at bentohr.com and wherever you find your favorite podcasts by searching Thinking Inside the Box. And if you enjoy the work we're doing here, consider leaving us a 5-star rating, a comment, and subscribing. It ensures you get updated whenever we release new content and really helps amplify our message. In today's episode, I chat with Murray Sabrin, the New York City-based Emeritus Professor of Finance at Ramapo College of New Jersey. Murray is a seasoned author and finance expert, writing about the impacts of the healthcare economy in scholarly and popular publications. His new book, The Finance of Healthcare, Wellness and Innovative Approaches to Employee Medical Insurance, provides key decision makers with the information they need to match optimum healthcare plans with the culture of their workforces. Americans spend more on medical care as a percentage of GDP than any other nation in the world. For the decade ending in 2020, insurance premiums in the United States rose 47% and deductibles jumped nearly 69%. Even with employer-based medical insurance benefits, employees now pay, on average, nearly $6,000 per year towards their employer's average of $22,000 for family coverage. With these rising costs, employers have been voting with their dollars by opting out of traditional medical insurance markets and looking for innovative solutions. Fortunately, promising alternatives to these traditional medical insurance schemes have emerged. By investigating the options now made available through medical entrepreneurs, employers can reduce medical insurance costs and put money back into their employees' pockets. It's a topic close to my heart, an evidence-based approach to helping employees. And I was fortunate enough to speak with Murray regarding the low-cost, high-quality medical care options available to employers in the United States. We discussed how a company's culture will dictate the most appropriate healthcare coverage, how wellness programs can give employers and help them achieve two major goals: keeping employees healthy while reducing medical care costs, and the role of patient-centered healthcare benefits in reducing absenteeism, increasing morale, productivity, and retaining key talent. Beyond that, it was a fascinating discussion, and I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did recording it. And now I bring you Murray Sabrin. Murray, one of my commitments to 2023 and to this podcast was to bring on different kinds of guests. If you look back at the previous 120 plus episodes of Thinking Inside the Box, we've talked a lot to organizational leaders, whether they be in human resources or marketing or founders of small enterprises. And in 2023, I want to take the opportunity to meet people that have different types of skill sets that bring a different lens to topics that ultimately affect all of us. And when I think about things like workplace wellness, in mental health, I think it's a problem that each of us are seeing take on increasing weight in our lives, both individually and collectively. And I'm just really excited for a conversation today with you about all things health, wellness, and and the like. Appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you, Matt, for inviting me. It's always a pleasure to talk about the issues that affect everyone, no matter what the income they have, where they live, or what their personal background is.
Yeah, and I think if the pandemic did any good, it's the fact that it did provide us with an opportunity to take a step back and really illuminate and reflect upon what we find important in our lives. And for a lot of people that I speak with, it's this reconnection to self, reconnection to family, reconnection to friends, to community that has taken on a real silver lining in amongst a really challenging couple of years. We're obviously going to talk a bit about some of those bigger trends and some of the impacts around enterprises. Before we get there, Murray, I'd love if you just wouldn't mind walking us through your background, your experiences, and what led you to today.
Well, I'll go reverse chronological order. I retired after 35 years of teaching finance at Ramapo College in New Jersey in July of 2020. And I got that job strictly by accident. I was teaching for a nonprofit organization when one of the professors came in one day. He was teaching at Ramapo, said a professor resigned a week before the semester began. And he asked me if I'd be interested in teaching finance and economics because I had a background in finance and economics before I started at Ramapo, even though I don't have a degree in finance, but I have work experience in the financial area. So I started teaching there on a temporary basis, and that turned into a 35-year career, which is what I wanted in 1971 when I was teaching in the New York City schools and decided to get a PhD so I could teach at the college level, because I just found that teaching in the intermediate school was not very intellectually stimulating for me, because I have a very curious mind. I was always curious about the world we live in. That's why I was a history major, geography minor, and concentrated in social studies education. And so in a nutshell, my background is a very broad-based social science background. And then I did work in the investment field, in the economic analysis field. And so I merged that all together. That turned into a teaching career. And one of my favorite courses was teaching the financial history of the United States in the business school, because students usually are taking very technical subjects, whether it's in finance, marketing, management, IT. And so this course was basically taken by finance majors, but some students from outside the finance program were taking it as well, because I guess they heard it was an interesting course. And I think I made it very interesting for them, because I still get emails from students saying what a wonderful experience it was learning about how the American financial system evolved and learning about the financial crises that we've had throughout American history. And then how did I come to get involved in healthcare economics and healthcare finance? Well, that's a very circuitous route also. I ran for governor in New Jersey in 1997 as a Libertarian Party candidate. And I met a couple doctors, husband and wife, who a few years later created a nonprofit medical center, health center in central New Jersey. And this was in my line of thinking of how do we deal with the healthcare needs of low-income folks. Prior to that, in 1991, Peter Drucker, who everyone knows in the, from the business world, the guru of management, wrote a wonderful piece in the Wall Street Journal about how nonprofits are the way to go to deliver social services to people that would be cost-effective, efficient, and solve problems. And so I kept that idea in back of my mind. And then when I met people who are actually doing it in the economy, I said, this is a great thing to get involved in. And so although they live far away from me, I financially supported them. And then a few years later, I hosted a healthcare symposium at Ramapo College. And one of the keynote speakers was Senator Corzine at the time, who then eventually became governor. And we didn't talk about this subject at all, but one of the what the luncheon speaker was Dr. Gene Cheslak of Red Bank, New Jersey, who created the Parker Family Health Center in his community because he saw a need of low-income workers not having any healthcare needs. And so I met him and we discussed it. And a few years earlier, I met with, or I spoke to, his name just blanked me. He's the creator of the Volunteers in Medicine Center in Hilton Head, South Carolina. And that's based upon the Mutual Aid Society. And the doctor told me that he saw there was a tremendous need in Hilton Head for patients, for individuals who work in low-income jobs who had no access to medical care. So he was able to get this accomplished. Again, based on totally voluntary contributions, there's no government involvement whatsoever. It's people who fall between the cracks between Medicaid and employer-based insurance. And so this model of volunteerism medicine has a long history in the United States of mutual aid societies that provide services to people at the local level without any federal government involvement, because people live in a specific community that have specific needs. And this is how America evolved for 200 plus years. And I'd like to see that expand throughout the country, because that would have a big impact positively in terms of eliminating eventually the $800 billion Medicaid budget that is putting a huge burden on state and local government budgets, which means taxpayers have to come up with that money. I just remembered his name, Dr. Jack McConnell. And Dr. Jack McConnell was a wonderful human being. He was a retired physician, and he was just able to muster the support and putting the community together for this medical care center. And I helped create one a few years later in the mid-2000s, when a physician who met with Dr. Cheslak, who spoke at Ramapo College, where I was teaching at the time, invited me to be a founding trustee of this nonprofit health center in Bergen County, New Jersey. And I immediately agreed, because if I'm interested in it from an academic and a practical point of view, I might as well put my hand in and try to help create one. And we certainly did that several years later. And that's a wonderful legacy, I think, for anyone that got involved, to build something in the community that's helping people. The doctors are volunteers, they're treating people, and it's run on a totally voluntary basis, nonprofit basis. And they do a magnificent job of making sure that people are getting better, whether they have diabetes or high blood pressure or any other of the chronic illnesses that is costing the American people $4 trillion a year when you add up all the healthcare costs in the country.
So I'll be honest, this is not an area of expertise that I have, but I'm, as a participant in society, I'm really curious about this, because you referenced earlier that the model that you're talking about is a more efficient model, ultimately a model that delivers better outcomes than the models that are currently present alongside of them. I'm just curious, from your perspective, why do you think that is?
Well, I think there's several reasons. One is there's no paperwork. Doctors love participating in a volunteers in medicine clinic, because there's absolutely no government regulation that you typically see in a medical practice, where doctors have to fill out Medicare forms, not them, of course, their staff, Medicaid forms, insurance forms. So doctors are under a lot of pressure to make sure they comply with all these rules and regulations from the insurance companies, from Medicare and Medicaid. And that's why they have to have a staff to do all the paperwork. In a volunteers in medicine health center, there's none of that. There's no paperwork except whatever regulations they have to file with the local government or the state government. But it's less bureaucratic, for one. And doctors enjoy it, because they don't have to spend only 10 minutes with a patient in a regular practice, 15 minutes with a patient. They could spend an hour with a patient, depending upon the patient's needs. So when I came across this model and seeing it in practice, I said, this is the way the country could go to solve one part of the healthcare puzzle, which is, how do we deal with low-income folks who don't have the ability to pay for out-of-pocket for medical needs? And then we can get into the conversation of how employers can help their employees get better outcomes at lower prices that would benefit everybody, the workers, and of course, the employers.
Yeah, I think that's a wise thing to do, to bring employers into the conversation, because I think in large part they have a role to play. And you mentioned earlier the outcomes. I'm curious. Obviously, this fills a unique need in a broader mosaic around healthcare. And it doesn't sound like you're purporting this to be the singular model, but rather a complementary model that supports the other models in there. I'm just curious, from your vantage point, if you're seeing a deficit. So I appreciate the model is predicated on volunteerism, which I think is incredible. And I completely agree that each of us who have privilege should dedicate a portion of our privilege to supporting other people in whatever shape that form that could take. And so for some physicians, dedicating their time to helping their communities is a great way to give back and to feel that stronger connection, that stronger sense of purpose. I'm curious about how that model works, or if you're encountering challenges around capacity, or the inverse of it, more demand than you can handle, in terms of what's the broader state of healthcare insofar as the services that you're providing or that model and people's ability to access those services.
Well, from what I gather, there are nonprofit health centers all across the country. Some of them are federal government created. And so from the research I did in this area is that, again, because it's federally government created, there's a lot of paperwork, bureaucracy, and I think they're under the pressure to see as many patients as possible in these centers while you don't have that that constraint, that time constraint in the nonprofit. So again, the nonprofit is, there's no agenda except helping people get better. And this ties into the whole notion of how healthcare, medical care is delivered in the country, because ideally, we want to make sure people are basically in charge of their own, quote, health by eating right, having exercise, enough sleep, proper nutrition, limiting their tobacco use or eliminating it completely, not drinking excessively. So we know what the metrics are to what the variables are to have optimal health. And so the challenge, I think, for employers who are paying a good portion of the insurance premiums for employees is how does that all mix in into having a workforce that is healthy, productive, and is not a huge burden to the bottom line of a business. And so that's what I try to do in my research, is to point out there are ways for employers to do that would meet all the criteria of a good benefits package that would solve a lot of these issues.
Yeah, and I think you're wise to point out that in a lot of cases, prevention is infinitely more efficient, as well as just, of course, financially, but it's just more efficient in terms of a system. If we can get ahead of potential challenges and talk about things that people can do around lifestyle and self-care and, you know, making some smart decisions around their health, then that's going to have a net positive effect for everyone. Because, of course, with each in any system, it's complex like this, there's strains put on the system. And as much as we can do our best to minimize our ability to strain the system, I think that's wise feedback. And I think you're wise again to point out that employers have a role to play in this. And I think if one thing we've seen over the pandemic is that the proliferation of mental health resources that are provided inside of organizations now, where predominantly before the pandemic, mental health was talked about, but it was very much the employee's responsibility to address their problems and challenges. And when the pandemic came into be and those two worlds collided in a way they hadn't collided traditionally, it became more incumbent upon organizations to provide access to resources because they understood the implications to things like business continuity and risk mitigation and customer service in a way that maybe not wasn't as relevant or wasn't as visible or wasn't as prevalent, you know, in a world before the pandemic. And, you know, you mentioned prevention habits. You mentioned the idea of you know, people taking control of their lives. I'm curious about, you know, maybe speak more a bit about the role that plays in terms of the business case for healthcare and the support that you're providing to your constituents and clients in that regard.
Yeah, I wellness programs are, I think, are taking off dramatically because this is the way that employers can make sure that their employees are in, to use a colloquial term, in tip-top shape, physically, mentally, and in the workplace, because one thing a company cannot afford these days is absenteeism. And we know some employers are having a difficult time hiring employees for a variety of reasons. As an employer, as a business decision maker, you want to make sure that your employees come to work on time, they do their work efficiently, effectively. And that requires good mental health and physical balance. And so I discuss wellness in my book because I think it's critical that especially large employers have something in place to help their employees, because we know the numbers about obesity are getting worse and worse. 40% of American adults are obese, and that percentage is going to go to 50% by 2030 if we don't reverse that trend. And as one doctor who created a direct primary care facility based in San Francisco and has done throughout the country, he decided to become a doctor, believe it or not, at age 5, because he saw his father working in an emergency room who complained about the lack of good quality healthcare in these New York City public hospitals. And so this youngster became a doctor and created this company called Go Forward, which is direct primary care. And his criticism of medical care is that he calls it not medical care, but sick care, is that we see doctors when we're sick, when we should be seeing doctors to improve our health. So we don't have to see doctors for medication and all these other therapeutics. But as Hippocrates told us 2,000 years ago, let food be thy medicine. And I think we're seeing more and more people, especially young people, being interested in sort of a naturopathic approach to better health rather than going to the doctor and getting some sort of medication for some illness that they have, when all that does, according to some people, is just treat the symptoms rather than the underlying causes.
Hey everyone, it's Matt here. I hope you're enjoying today's discussion. And before we continue, I wanted to make you aware of my latest creative project, This Week at Work. Presented in partnership with my good friend, Chris Rainey of HR Leaders, each Friday we'll live stream on LinkedIn at 7 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. That's 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time and 3 p.m. GMT for our European viewers. And together, bring you the latest trends, news on topics emanating from organizations, everything from culture to technology and the future of work. Joining is easy. Just follow me on LinkedIn, click the bell at the top right-hand side of my profile, and you'll get notified when we go live each week. And whether you do experience the content live or later, if you've been following me for a while, you'll no doubt recognize the fun banter Chris and I have developed over the years. And whether it's been podcasts or digital events, we're so excited to again bring you the topics affecting today's workplaces and their leaders. And now, back to our discussion.
I have a longtime friend who became a naturopath 20-some-odd years ago, and he's doing great work in northern New Jersey because he works with physicians, oncologists, cardiologists, and other so-called traditional physicians to make sure that the patient is getting the best possible treatment and finding out the underlying causes of their illnesses rather than just treating it with some prescription. And he's been very successful helping cancer patients and patients who have heart disease and obesity. So there are a lot of illnesses out there that he feels can be treated successfully with a more naturopathic approach. And so the question is, can employers utilize all the resources that are out there? Because some of them may not know about these approaches because most people look at medicine as traditional approach. You have an illness, you go to the doctor, you get a prescription, you go home, and hopefully you get better. And if it does get better, you may need hospitalization or surgery. So I think more and more young people especially would like to take care of their own healthcare needs. And that's why I think entrepreneurship is so important for young people today. Again, having taught in the business school for 35 years, young people, from what I saw in my little world of teaching finance and couple hundred students a year, is that they're very entrepreneurial. They want to either be in a company which gives them entrepreneurial opportunities or strike out on their own and open up a business online or the least costly way to set up a business. And we know you can set up a business online virtually in the same day that you may have a good idea. And so I think that's the exciting part of medical care. It's on the one hand, it's becoming more entrepreneurial, and the other hand, it's becoming more bureaucratic as physicians are now being gobbled up by hospitals, that doctors' practices are being gobbled up by hospitals. So you're getting the corporatization of medical care. And how do you deal with that from an employer's vantage point, where you only may think of a traditional indemnity policy with one of the big carriers, Blue Cross Blue Shield, United, Aetna, and so on and so forth. But we know that a lot of companies are doing self-insurance. And so that is an interesting aspect of medical care, is that companies are self-insuring in order to drive down their costs. So there's a lot of things that employees can do. And I think the first thing to do is do an audit of their workers and see where their workers would like to be in terms of their own healthcare goals, and then take it from there and bring in the nutritional consultants, the fitness consultants, and say, here's the programs we can have for you. And the goal is, which everyone wants, is to be in optimal health. I don't know anyone who doesn't want to be in optimal health, but the point is sometimes you have to make some very important changes in your life. Because we know what the causes are, and the CDC tells us what they are. It's the physical inactivity, the poor nutrition, the excessive alcohol use, and of course, lack of sleep. There's been a lot of research done about how sleep is one of the critical components of wellness, and that the American people, especially young people, are not getting enough sleep. And we know from basic physiology, sleep is very important to rejuvenate the body. And if you don't get enough sleep, that's when a lot of chronic illnesses may start to set in. And if they fester, they can really turn into some very bad outcomes. If all these things that we know people should be doing are not doing, that's when medical costs increase dramatically.
And I think you're wise to point out the breadth of different practitioners and levels of expertise that you need now to focus in on modern day healthcare. It's much more integrative than it once was. And we've traditionally placed a large burden on general practitioners in our health systems to be able to be, you know, miracle workers in a lot of cases, when it's just the human body is so complex, anatomy is complex, the levels of, you know, situations we find ourselves in individually and collectively in society now is more complex, and we're gaining more knowledge all the time. So I think, you know, to talk about naturopaths, to talk about different types of practitioners, whether they be health consultants, whether they be nutritional consultants, you know, I've spoken a little bit about the psychological parts of things. I mean, there's an integrated approach to healthcare going forward that needs to be looked at in broad context. But I think as we bring things to the enterprise lens, to employee lenses, to an organization lens, I think it's about, to your point, starting from a place of we all want to be healthier, and we all want to live on this planet for as long as we can in a level of health that makes that an enjoyable experience. And at the same time, we have to appreciate that these services are complex and complicated, and that access to them is limited in some cases. And it's, you know, there's a lot of things that go into play. You know, obviously my vantage point on this traditionally has been through the mental health lens. And I think about some of the habits you talk about, whether it's overeating or overconsumption of alcohol or consumption of drugs. A lot of these types of habits, which are not in any way in someone's best interest from a health perspective, a lot of these activities are undertaken as a consequence of trauma and as a consequence of people's inability to regulate or to manage through life's inevitable ebbs and flows. People disassociate. It's so much easier to disassociate, hop on your phone for a couple of hours and go down an Instagram rabbit hole than it is to ask questions about yourself and how you're showing up in certain relationships. And it's easier to overindulge and to be indulgent around drugs and alcohol, as opposed to, you know, willing to have tough conversations. And I'm not trying to demonize those habits, but I'm rather quite the opposite, trying to illuminate that it's complex and that we need to look at an integrated approach to health if you're going to address this. Just giving someone a meal plan isn't going to solve the problem in the same way giving them a personal trainer alone isn't going to solve them, in the same way hiring them a psychologist isn't going to give them a problem. It needs to be looked at more broadly. And that's where I think, you know, services like what you're talking about and systems that we're speaking about give people greater knowledge than ever before about how to take their health into their own hands, and appreciation that it's just not realistic to expect the healthcare system, in whatever way, shape, or form it finds itself, to be the entity that's going to save you. Like, you need to take on that personal responsibility if you're going to really maximize the time you have on this planet.
Well, that's correct, because we all want to live a nice, long, healthy life. And the question is, how do you do that given all the complexities of life, as you point out, and especially the pandemic has really had a major impact on human beings, especially young people, the isolation that they faced. Again, anecdotally, my last semester at the college, one of my students was a former student who was in my classes 30 years ago, and he came back to finish a degree or take more courses. And at the end of the semester, he told me one of his childhood friends committed suicide because he couldn't take it anymore. And this is right at the beginning of the pandemic in April of 2020. As the pandemic unfolded, there are a lot of people that couldn't cope with that. The isolation was hurting them. They had no social interaction with friends and colleagues and family. And some people just couldn't take it anymore. And this is the sad reality of what the pandemic did in terms of people's mental health. And I think we're going to see the consequences of that, of the pandemic fallout for years and years to come, if not decades to come, because we don't know what the long-term consequences will be on the 5-year-olds, the 10-year-olds that were isolated for a couple of years. And so I think this is the challenge we have as a society, is how do we deal with this when there may be a great need for mental health services, and there may not be enough practitioners to deal with people adequately. This is probably one of the greatest challenges we're going to face in our country's medical history, is that the pandemic, not only having physical consequences, has had enormous mental health consequences. And we'll see how this thing plays itself out. But we're seeing a lot more data coming out about people's inability to get back on track to where they were before the pandemic. And that's why the demand for anti-anxiety drugs, antidepressants has increased exponentially in the last 3 years. And so the question is, how do we get people back to a more settled lifestyle where they can deal with the issues around them? And this is where I think a holistic approach has to take place between the workplace and the employees, between the employees and the families, with their health, with their healthcare practitioners, whether it's doctors or counselors. So this is going to be, I think, one of the more difficult decades in our history.
I couldn't agree more. And we talk about this, we've talked about this through the entirety of this conversation, and you referenced it quite thoroughly in your most recent book, The Finance of Healthcare, Wellness and Innovative Approaches to Employee Medical Insurance. I thought it was a really good view of just the broader economics around healthcare and its implications to various parts of society. And you know, one thing you talk about at length in the book, it's this concept around patient centricity, which is a term that is very common in the medical field. But for those of us who do not spend a majority of our time in the medical field, I'd be curious just to overall about your thoughts and definition on patient centricity, but more explicitly, how a health benefits package in the future can be designed around patient centricity and the impact that that can have on things like employee engagement, morale, absenteeism, and the like.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, I take it from my experience as a youngster growing up in New York City in the 1950s and 60s, where if you were ill and you could go to the doctor, you would visit the doctor and you'd spend not 5 minutes, 10 minutes or 15 minutes, sometimes a half an hour, 45 minutes with the doctor, going over your illnesses, your illness and just chatting about things in general. And you'd pay for the doctor's visit. It was $5 back then. Then went to $7. And if you needed a prescription for an antibiotic or cough medicine, you get a prescription, you fill it at the local pharmacy. And it was all cash-based. There was no insurance for that. And then my father had a major operation in 1961. He was a blue-collar worker. He had Blue Cross Blue Shield through his workplace. And from what I remember, there was no financial burden on the family because he had a major operation in a top hospital in New York City. And so that model has been replaced by this overinsurance of medical care, that we have insurance for just about every single thing that we do in a doctor's office or in a hospital. And so what I would like to see happen is employees become more proactive and find out what's the best model for their employees, given the culture of the workplace. And one thing that has intrigued me is the direct primary care, DPC, where doctors have patients who pay a monthly fee, either as an individual or a family, and it's quite affordable from the prices I've seen around the country. For a family of four, I think the price may be something like $200, $250 a month, maybe $300, depending upon which locale you're in. So for an average family, they could pay that out of pocket, or the employer could pay for that. And then you get a catastrophic policy for major operations. And even those operations, the cost of that could decline substantially. And I'll give you one example of that, Matt. When I was researching my previous book on healthcare, I interviewed a direct primary care physician here in Southwest Florida. And she had a patient who didn't have insurance, who needed a major operation. And the local hospital quoted him a price of $20,000 for the operation. And so the doctor said to this her patient, "You've got to call the Surgery Center of Oklahoma, which does a cash-only approach to surgery." And he called them up. He went, got the operation. He had to fly there, had to stay in a hotel, whatever. The whole thing cost $5,000 instead of $20,000 for the local hospital in Southwest Florida. So by having competition, by having these surgery centers, high quality, founded by doctors, owned by doctors, who collaborate with doctors who come in to do the surgery, and the prices are a fraction of what the hospitals are charging the insurance companies, who then have to charge the employer. So you see, by having the patient out of the picture, because the patient is really at the mercy of the insurance company and the employer, we have very inflated surgery costs in this country. And there's some doctors who think that these costs can go down by 50% or more for major surgeries, and sometimes 75%. And so when you have that type of competition out there, we should be able to bring our medical care costs down, which would be a big boon to businesses, since they're paying the bulk of insurance costs today. And so if employers making noise that they would like to see more competition, they would like to see more direct primary care physicians in their community, they'd like to see more surgery centers in their communities, we could reduce that $4 trillion a year medical care cost probably by 50%, which would free up a tremendous amount of resources for infrastructure, for retirement benefits, for 401k plans, and so on and so forth. So there is a huge incentive, I think, for the country as a whole to tackle the medical insurance costs with approaches that are being used right now around the country that are creating lower expenses for employers. And so that, I think, is the exciting aspect of what I've uncovered in the research I've done for the past couple of years.
Yeah, I think it's the right thing when you're looking at a broader sense around healthcare to be, again, trying to look at ways to incent people to undertake the right things in service to their own health, to create incentives in the network for organizations to participate in the health of their employees, and to understand that at the end of the day, we're all making trade-off decisions, and that, you know, when we apply intention to things as important as our health, inevitably everybody wins. And it's one of those things where I think, again, the silver lining over the last couple of years has been as people take a look at their health with a bit more of a fine-tooth comb, a deeper magnifying lens on how things are showing up in their life, I think people are having a greater understanding of how their health really does impact their overall wellness and satisfaction. That, you know, if you are a healthy person, if you are somebody who is looking after your health, inevitably your quality of life is going to improve alongside of that, and that you're going to be able to get so much more juice from the lemon, as it were. So I think understanding that and understanding that people are naturally incentivized to do that, but also being realistic about the fact that everything we're talking about here is not new information. Like, I mean, I think most would accept the fact that if you intake less calories than you burn, that you're probably going to end up losing weight more often than not, and sleeping right, eating right, not overconsuming substances that are bad for you. I mean, we most of us have this level of knowledge and awareness. The traditional challenges have been, it's not a skill issue, it's more of a will issue in some cases, or there's some other challenges that exist outside that individual that make it, whether it's access because of finances or geography, wherever that might be, but there's things that prevent people from actually realizing that. So I think understanding how complex this is, I think, you know, obviously speaks to the work that you've done. The depth of analysis and review in the book, I think, was excellent. So thank you for taking a different view on this. You know, Murray, I'm thinking about going forward, and I think about 2023 and this being hopefully for most of us a transitionary year as we put the pandemic largely behind us and focusing on putting things back together, creating a new vision for ourselves individually and collectively. I'm curious, what's your plans as you look forward to 2023 and beyond? What are some of the things that you're thinking about? Maybe some of the goals you set for yourself.
Since I retired, I've written 4 books, which I never thought I'd be able to do that, but I was able to write these 4 books. And my latest one is my autobiography, which discusses my coming to America as basically an infant in 1949 and through 1997 when I ran for governor in New Jersey, and seeing all the issues that people were concerned about. And so healthcare being the 800-pound gorilla in America with a $4 trillion price tag, it's taking up so much resources that And we don't have great outcomes. We're spending the most of any country on a per capita basis and the most of GDP, and we don't have a good outcome in terms of longevity and chronic illnesses. So money is not the answer. It's certainly not the answer, because doctors will tell you it's about people being in charge of their own decision-making and making better decisions than they're doing today. And so what I would like to do is continue to speak out about alternatives to what we have today, because that would be a great boon to employers and employees. And I'm concerned about the future of the economy in terms of the business cycle, which I've written about in my book that came out last year, actually in 2021. And so I take a big picture approach, and a lot of things that I've discussed emanate from my own personal experience growing up in New York City in the 50s and 60s. And on a personal level, my book is, my autobiography is about really several things that about my life that I think is, I hope, inspirational to people when they read it. It's about perseverance. It's about a positive mental attitude. It's about persistence and luck, how that played a role in my life. And so I always try to have a positive mental attitude, because if we have to be optimistic, we have to feel that the future will be brighter than it is today. And I've always taken that approach when there were times in my life where it didn't look very optimistic to me. And so I think this is where coping skills come in. And a lot of these things that happened to me were when I was a youngster. And so I learned early on that you have to have that positive mental attitude and just persevere, and better outcomes will take place. And so I hope that that gives some courage to people, that no matter how, to use a cliche, dark it is in their life, the dawn is right around the corner. And we know that it's always darkest before the dawn. So you've got to just keep your chin up and persevere and have purpose in life. That's another thing that I've discovered in observing people either around me or in the workplace. You've got to have purpose. And if you don't have purpose, then you're sort of drifting. And when you're drifting, that's when outcomes could be not optimal. You could fall into a pattern of overeating, overdrinking, other things that could happen that that can cause chronic illnesses. And so I try to be a role model, if you will, in terms of, yes, there's adversity in everyone's life. The question is, how do you deal with it and how do you move on so you can have that purposeful life?
What a great place to end this. Murray, thanks so much for your time today. I really enjoyed the conversation and you illuminating some things for us that we haven't really talked about on the show before. So thank you for that. And for those interested, I'm going to link all of Murray's details in the podcast show notes, including a link to his latest book, so you can have a chance to pick that up. Murray, wish you the best in 2023 and look forward to staying in touch.
Thank you so much, Matt. I'd love to do it again because we all want to make America better and improve people's lives. And that's what I'm committed to do in my post-college teaching career.
Bento HR is a digital transformation consultancy working at the intersection of strategy, technology, and people operations. We partner with organizations, private equity, and venture capital firms to accelerate value creation and identify the organization's highest leverage initiatives. And this can take place in many forms, from strategic planning and alignment to technology procurement, implementation, and integration, along with organizational design, process reengineering, and change management. With our proven track record of working with complex, high-growth organizations, we provide a lens that goes beyond the balance sheet, increasing enterprise readiness, resilience, and value. For more information, check us out at bentohr.com.